Wrong. Her mind had screamed as her hand skimmed over him, searching for a wound, a bandage, that might explain the exhaustion, the weakness. Pattern. She hated that word now, the lack of control it implied. The way it had hooked into what Henry had told her in Russia, grown through her like a winding, barbed vine. You will see the pattern, too. They were both wrong. Asha didn't have to accept that anything was meant to happen. She had been orphaned in Damascus, flung centuries away from Nicholas. But that was nothing compared to being trapped almost 300 years ahead of him, locked away from her family, from the thorns, from this hidden life. This wasn't a pattern unless she let it become one. We cannot possess the things and people not meant for us. We cannot control every outcome. We cannot cheat death. Etta hardened herself, straining to listen to the sound of her feet, so she wouldn't have to hear Henry's words rising in her mind again, to see his bloodied face. Etta stepped up to the table, feeling the icy pressure of the Belladonna's gaze on her. When she was sure she'd released enough of her frustration in order to keep her expression neutral, Etta met her eyes and held out the offer. The woman plucked it out of her hand like a petal off a flower. Standing near the table, Etta picked up the murmurs of the bidders, the debates they were having with themselves, as if all of their words had been funneled into that exact spot. But even those conversations were lost to the sound of the blood rushing in her ears. If she reached out, she'd be able to brush the smooth, dark wood of the box that held the astrolabe. The candlelight caught all of the intricate detail, the etchings and marks of the device resting on the box's velvet interior. Etta had held it for only a moment, but she recognized it all the same. The flames flickered with her next step forward, and the sight gripped her, made her hold the next breath she drew in. Because when the flames danced, so did the image of the burly guards. A projection. An impressive one. How? Don't do it. Don't do it. But she couldn't help herself. She brushed her fingers against the edge of the astrolabe's box. The lid snapped down. The Belladonna's long fingers, knotted at the joints, held it firmly in place.
"I see your heart," the woman said. "It cannot be you."
The scream set Etta's pulse stuttering long before she saw the splash of dark blood against the curtain. A piercing laugh followed, an attack on her eardrums, and her legs were suddenly weak beneath her. Them. The Belladonna merely took a step back, crossed her arms over her chest, and watched as the same bidder's body was tossed through the curtain, landing in a sickening, blood-soaked heap in the central aisle, his mask askew. The force of it blew out the candles at the table, and the guards vanished like shadows meeting sunlight. Etta barely swallowed her gasp of shock as she turned toward the Belladonna. But the woman's face was impassive as she watched a new figure emerge at the entrance of the tent. It must have been a man, for he was broad in the shoulders and seemed almost inhumanly tall. He was draped in a shimmering cloak of gold and silver threads that made him look like a flickering flame. He reached up and slowly lowered the hood, never breaking eye contact with the Belladonna. His shock of white hair was combed back neatly over his skull, and though Etta recognized his face as human, all of his features seemed to be exaggerated by the desperate way his skin clung to his pointed chin and prominent cheekbones. The arch of his brow was severe, and several veins bulged across his forehead. He looked as if he'd been carved from wax. Patches of his skin seemed to gleam as gold as his cloak, while others were gray and flaking. But even in decay, he seemed radiant. The small boy, the Belladonna's servant, had been sitting to one side of the table, his book open in his lap. Now he stood, calmly shutting the cover, and left through the rear of the tent.
"It's been a lifetime," the Belladonna called to him. "And now we find ourselves here again. I might have known it was you. What an intriguing reinvention. And more intriguing still that you did not consume this one, this time.
The man walked with an eerie silence. The only sound was his long golden robe whispering against the stone ground.
You know, I've been quite content with two lives, the second of which will keep me in comfort for many years yet.
The Belladonna's eyes drifted down the length of the man, skimming over the worn edges of his form.
It seems the same cannot be said for you. I wonder how long you would have without it. I could not have drawn you out if you were anything short of desperate. Unless, of course, you merely wish to see the flock. I admit they are amusing, from time to time.
I am as impervious to your words as I am to your blades,
he said, the words chiming like a song.
We shall see.
Atta almost jumped clear out of her skin. It sounded as though the Belladonna were standing directly beside her, whispering the words loudly to her for the man to overhear.
Why, it looks as though a single spark would set you aflame.
A shadow passed over the man's face. That strike, at least, had landed.
I felt your mark upon that child, that young man, and spared his life only to amuse myself by killing him in front of you. This game is at its end, sister.
The Belladonna gazed back, as serene and still as the moon.
And so it is.
The man's eyes were like sunlight passing through glass, intensifying as they fixated on something. As I felt the gaze burn through her skin, to her core, and his eyes flicked over to her. They narrowed as if in recognition, and terror froze her in place. She sucked in a sharp breath. At that moment, darkness broke loose from the closest stall and flooded the tent with night. Blood slapped the white canvas, the fabric rending as a body was thrown through. It rolled over to them, limbs flapping, sucking wounds visible, until the stranger, a traveler Atta didn't recognize, gazed up at her, unseeing. She was pinned by that moment, unable to get her feet under her again. The screams of the other travelers tore through her ears, but she couldn't work up one of her own, could barely breathe.
Atta!
Nicholas, Sophia, and Julian tore out of their stalls as she dove for the table, for the box, for the astrolabe. Her fingers closed around it, and she felt the familiar pulse of the astrolabe's power inside. The air pulled around her, her only warning before she was blown off her feet by the impact of someone slamming into her. The ground rushed up to greet her. No, no, no! The box flew out of her hands as she fell, her vision blanking out with the force of her impact on the stone. She heard the wood splinter, her knife, her sole weapon, clattered as it danced away. But before she could reach for either, a torrent of black fell over her. Hot spittle flew in her eyes. The attacker's weight was oppressive, as if trying to force her deeper into the ground. Atta choked on her next breath as the man leaned low, coming close enough for her to smell the decay emanating from his rotting teeth. His claw-like dagger dug into her upper arm and twisted. With a cry, Atta managed to unpin one hand long enough to catch his jaw, desperately reaching with the other for the knife she'd lost, muscles straining, fingers grasping. A sword swung out, its dull edge catching the shadow on the side of his head. The blow was enough to stun him, but not to knock him off her chest. Atta managed to wriggle that last inch to the left, latch onto her knife, and without any thought but getting out from under his weight, slammed the blade upward, into the only place she could find without armor, his neck. The spill of dark blood made her stomach riot as it bubbled from the man's wound. The shadow was shoved away from her, and she sucked the smoky air into her already burning lungs. Atta scrambled to her feet, assisted by a hand that gripped her beneath one shoulder. She whirled.
Are you hurt?
Henry stood there, his white robe splattered with blood. A bruise covered his skin from his temple to his jaw, and he couldn't seem to fully straighten to his full, powerful height. But it was him. Alive. Etta felt the burn of tears in her eyes and choked on her words. His face was so unusually soft as he looked at her that she had to wonder if he'd mistaken her shock for fear. She stumbled forward, surprising both of them as her arms wrapped around his center, as she buried her face in his shoulder. Alive.
Are you all right?
He asked, one tentative hand touching the back of her head. Behind him, around him, men and women burst through the entrance of the tent, in clothing that ranged in style from the 20th century to the first, weapons in hand. Leading the charge was Li Min, shrouded in black silk. The young woman shot forward, skimming through the carnage, seemingly searching. Nicholas and Sophia were locked in the middle of a blood-soaked circle, the bodies piling around them, choking them off from the rest of the room, from the attackers, the victims, the men and women who clutched their dead, screaming, until they too were silenced. With the smoke filling the space, it was nearly impossible to tell a shadow from a shadow. Nicholas stumbled, taking a blow to his back that brought him to his knees. Li Min drew herself back, just like an arrow notched on a bow. And then she was flying again, straight for him. She pulled a small dagger from her boot, launching it at the neck of the shadow who'd cornered them at the table. The range of emotions that exploded across Sophia's face at the sight of the other girl was indescribable.
"You are not forgiven!" she shouted.
Li Min kicked a silver serving platter up off the wreckage of canvas and wood on the floor. A man, an Ironwood, had taken up a gun and aimed, but she used the heavy platter to deflect the shot away from Nicholas and Sophia, and then to knock the man clear off his feet. In her next move, she seemed to produce a sword out of thin air, driving it through the back of the shadow who had recovered enough to swing her claw and sword at Sophia's face. Nicholas, his face fixed in determination, ripped the blade out from between her shoulders and proceeded to slash her with the cold dispassion of someone who'd fought and thrived in many more battles than his opponent could ever imagine. Sophia gripped the front of Lehman's cloak, drew her in and kissed her soundly, as the flames from the nearby candles caught the tent and set it ablaze.
"Thorns!"
someone shouted above the shrieks, the vibrations of the Dark One's speech, the screams of agony and fear as the travelers tried to flee. Another voice.
"Hemlock!"
Henry spun Etta away. She heard, rather than saw, the explosion of a gunshot that ripped through the din of clanging metal. He jerked, but didn't fall. Etta reached up, trying to pull back to see where he'd been hit, only to find that a man in a trim suit behind him was already slumping to the ground, shot clean through the skull. The smoke from the burning stall began to fill the air, but it lifted as her mother stepped forward without a mask, her rifle still raised, pointed now at Henry, who calmly brought up his sword, bringing it to rest at the spot where Rose's long, pale neck met her shoulder. She, too, was wearing the white auction robes, though now she had painted herself red and black with blood and smoke. Etta pulled back from Henry with a jerk of alarm. Rose's cool expression slipped at the sight of them, cracking enough for her relief to bleed through.
"Can you get her out of here?" Henry asked.
Rose said nothing, only nodded.
"No!"
Etta ripped herself out of his grip.
"You don't understand. The astrolabe. You can't destroy it."
A familiar cry had Etta spinning back around. Nicholas had taken cover behind the overturned table with Sophia and Li Min. As one, they lifted it and used it as a battering ram, charging into the two shadows who'd begun taking turns driving their claws through the body of one of the thorns on the ground, trying to crawl over another wounded young man. When she looked toward her mother, Rose was nearly unrecognizable in her bone-pale terror. Etta turned slowly. It was the quiet, the way he absorbed the sounds around him like a vacuum, that was so deeply disturbing. The walls seemed to kneel to him, leaning forward, as if with each step he quietly devoured more of the world. The man in gold glided forward through the wreckage. The fighting fell away from him, the shadowed attackers drawing their prey into the stalls like predators wanting to feast on their kills. The hem of his robe was soaked up to the knee with blood. Henry reached for her, but it was her mother who seized her. Etta found herself tucked between her mother's back and the wall of the tent as the glittering man passed by. This close, his face had the consistency of rice paper. For a terrifying moment, Etta imagined she could see the dark blood throbbing through his root-like veins. But she wasn't shaking. Her mother was. Rose Linden, who had hunted tigers, betrayed Ironwoods, conquered an unfamiliar future, was shaking. As if that same raw fear carried vibrations through the air, the radiant man stopped suddenly, turning toward them, his eyes seeking. Recognition flared as he found Rose, his lips curving into a horrifying imitation of a smile.
"Hello, child."
A whisper. A curse. Knowledge flooded Etta, filling the cracks in the picture she had begun to assemble of her mother's life. Henry stepped in front of them both, but the man had no interest in him. As the man passed by, her father recoiled, as if the man had brushed his soul. There was something about the way the air itself seemed to curl and vibrate around the man, bowing to him, that made Etta's stomach clench again.
"My God! My God, Rosie!" Henry said, turning toward her.
"You... believe me!"
The vulnerability in her mother's words was shattering.
"I'm sorry," Henry said,
so softly that Etta wasn't sure her mother could hear him over the swarm of fighting. It felt as if she were standing in the path of two hurricanes, finally on the verge of collision, the winds of clashing blades and blood whipping around them.
"Etta!"
Etta pulled herself free from her mother at Sophia's bellow. Sophia was standing back to back with Lee Min now, staving off two thorns who had blades of their own.
"Ironwood's got it!"
Etta searched through the blazing fire and darkness until she found the place where the flames had eaten a hole in the side of the tent. There she saw an older man, his mask still on, rushing out into the courtyard, dodging the Shinto priests as they attempted to throw buckets of water onto the flames to stifle the fire before it jumped the temple. Between her and that opening, however, was Nicholas, with a shadow clinging to his back. One clawed hand was on the verge of raking across his throat, no matter how hard Nicholas tried to buck his attacker off. His palm came up to block the next swipe of the claws, and the blood instantly pooled where they cut deep into his flesh. Etta rushed toward him, but then Julian seemed to materialize out of thin air, shooting the man with what she thought must have been Sophia's flintlock. The bullet wasn't enough to deter the shadow for long, but it was enough for Nicholas to reclaim his sword from the ground. The shadow lunged again, but as Nicholas moved, the small leather cord he wore around his neck escaped his robe, and a large bead swung from beneath his shirt. Etta might have imagined it. Smoke was gathering heavily around them, masking them in silver. But when the shadow stabbed at his heart, the bead caught the tip of the blade. The shadow seemed almost enraptured by the unexpected sight, and seizing his chance, Nicholas swung the blade back with as much strength as he had in him, bringing it down on the shadow. "Astrolabe. Ironwood," she reminded herself. The last sight Etta had before rushing out into the courtyard was of the Belladonna, standing where she had stood the entire night, watching the blood creep along the stones and absorb the ashes at Julian's and Nicholas's feet. She surveyed the fight with the long-suffering look of a mother. Then she turned and left through a wall of fire and smoke, disappearing into the star-encrusted belly of the night. The moon was high and bright above her as she ran, searching for Ironwood's figure down the path, among the trees, in any crevice the snake could have slithered into. The passage at the base of the mountain would have closed up with the first traveler's death, but he had the astrolabe. He could create his own escape, and then seal the entrance and prevent anyone from following behind. The air was clean and sweet in her lungs, but Etta couldn't stop coughing, hacking up the smoke and spit and bile from deep inside her chest as she ran, her feet struggling in the soft earth. "Damn it," she thought. He couldn't take the astrolabe now. Not after everything.
"Etta! Etta, where are you?"
Nicholas's frantic voice carried down from above, but she didn't stop. She had caught another voice on the wind.
Face me. Face me once and for all. Let us end this.
Etta stumbled down the weathered path, stopping just long enough to keep herself upright, before picking up her pace again. Ironwood's shout sent birds launching from the safety of their branches. The man had torn away his mask and robe, revealing a fine suit beneath. He was pacing up and down the path, his breathing ragged. His hand clenched at what remained of his hair, twisting it. Rivulets of sweat poured off him, along with the stench of blood.
"I know you're out there,"
he shouted, to the trees, to the darkness.
"It's mine, do you hear me? Come for it again, and I'll tear you apart, limb from limb."
Etta had only had one real interaction with the man, but the frantic quality of his speech, the way he paced and screamed as if the words were being torn from him, made her feel like she was meeting him for the first time. His control over himself, his family, the machinations of the world, had been so tight and refined. She couldn't reconcile that man with the knotted mess of anxiety and desperation in front of her. This was the same person who had bent time to his will, who had subjected whole families to his cruelty.
"Do you hear me, you devil?" he shouted.
She came up short, a few feet away, but Cyrus Ironwood didn't seem to notice. The empty box lay overturned nearby, and he was waving the astrolabe in the air, holding it up for the moon to witness, as if expecting something to swoop down and snatch it. A torch in his hand nestled him in the center of a shallow pool of light.
"Ironwood,"
Etta said, walking toward him slowly. She kept the knife in her hand pressed to her side. He spun toward her, eyes flashing. It was like looking in the face of a child, one who'd been struck once and knew he was about to be hit again. His rage was nearly choking him, polluting the cool mountain air. She had a knife on her. He had only a torch. And the astrolabe.
"Give it to me," she said, holding out her hand. "It's over."
Ironwood swung around toward her, his gaze clouding.
"Over. The Ancient One is dead."
"Ancient One?" Etta swallowed, nodded. She reached out her free hand, repeating, "Give me the astrolabe."
"It's mine,"
he told her, the rough lines of his face painted with blood and soot. His mouth twisted up in glee.
"Years. Years. It's mine, finally, and mine alone."
Her fingers curled more tightly around the knife. She was close enough to smell his sweat now. Without giving him a second to prepare, Etta lunged forward, grabbing for the astrolabe. With a speed she didn't expect, his arm flew out, backhanding her sharply across the face. And suddenly his rage had a target, a focus. Etta stumbled back, swinging her knife between them to try and keep him back. The torch dropped from his hand, but didn't go out as it struck the path. Ironwood swung the astrolabe toward her temple, heavy and unyielding, and it narrowly missed crushing her skull. But she was off balance, and Ironwood seized the advantage and dropped his head, charging her with a rough yell, throwing her down onto her back. Etta's breath left her in a rush as she rolled to avoid his next blow, but not quickly enough. Ironwood caught her by the hair and yanked her back down, hard enough to tear a clump of it out at the roots. The knife was out of her hand and in his, the blade flashing in the moonlight.
"You want this?"
he cried, holding the astrolabe in front of her face. Etta reached for it, but Ironwood drew it back so sharply, so suddenly, that it went flying from his sweat-slick fingers. With a cry, he dove for it, but Etta yanked his leg back and dragged herself forward, snatching it just long enough to throw it as hard as she could into the dark forest, out of his reach. Etta couldn't hear the words he screamed at her over her thundering pulse. She only felt him slam her back to the ground, flipping her over again, his spittle flying in her face. She kicked, trying to claw at his face, but the knife was back in his hand, and suddenly at her cheek, dragging the blade down against it. He closed his other hand over her throat.
"You did this, all of you. You did this,
Atta reached up, trying to drive her fingers into his eyes, her broken nails clawing at his face.
"Rose!"
he howled down at her, his eyes unfocused.
"Rose Linden, are you satisfied? Are you satisfied?"
The sound the blade made as it pierced him from behind, the sickeningly wet thump and the spray of blood across her face, would never leave Etta as long as she lived. Then the blade was torn back through his body, and she was forced to watch as he choked on his own hot blood, his hand pressed to the gaping wound in his chest. His head turned as he slumped to the side, his fingers finally becoming lax enough for Etta to scramble out from underneath him.
"No,"
Rose said, wiping her blade against the side of her tattered white robe.
"Now I have my satisfaction."
Etta stared up at her from the ground, willing the feeling back into her limbs. Her mother stared down at her, her skin tight over delicate bones.
"Rose!"
Henry's voice echoed down from the top of the mountain path. Rose turned, not toward the sound, but behind her, just as the man in the golden robe slashed a claw-like blade over her throat. 31. Nicholas heard only Etta's scream. It flew to him over the sounds of savage fighting and the moans and begging of the wounded.
"Oh, God!"
Sophia said, swinging around, searching for its source. Lehman took her hand and led them both out of the tent at a full run. Nicholas tried to dash after them, but he stumbled, his entire right side limp. He cursed his body, the weakness that threatened to dissolve him at his joints. The Belladonna. But then there was an arm around his side, and his arm was being thrown over his shoulder. And Julian was there, sweat-soaked and grim. He glanced over at Nicholas, and at his brother's nod of acquiescence, dragged them both forward. The last of the travelers shoved themselves through the burning mouth of the tent, only to be pursued by the shadows, who left the massacre inside to claim more lives. Nicholas turned to look back, taking stock. There were dozens of bodies on the floor, both travelers and shadows alike. Nearly the whole of Ironwood's traveling force, and an equal number of Thorns. More dead than he had ever realized were alive. How many of our kind survive now? Near the entrance, a woman was crawling, laboring through the gore and flames to an older man, crying, "Father? Father?" Beside her, another man rocked the unmoving body of a younger one, weeping. Julian hurried by, and then they followed the path the silvery smoke was taking, along the mountain path. But no sooner had they taken a few long strides down it, than the nightmare claimed them, too. For there was their grandfather, choking on his last gasps of life, clawing at the ground beneath him. There was Rose Linden in Henry Hemlock's arms, her hand pressed to the line of blood at her throat. There was the man in gold, striding toward the dark line of the forest, searching. There was Etta, illuminating them all with the single torch in her hands. There was Etta, throwing it as hard as she could. The fire spun end over end, striking the back of the ornate robe, right where a powerful sun had been embroidered. The blaze took hold like a spark on brittle parchment. The sound, the whoosh of purifying, ravaging fire, as it caught the ends of the man's hair and lit him like a fuse, would never leave Nicholas, however long he lived. Nor would the look of quiet disbelief as the alchemist's son looked back over his shoulder at a sobbing Etta, in the instant before he was fully engulfed. Lehman and Sophia stood a few feet from them on the path, thunderstruck by the sight. He had to believe it was the stink of scorched flesh that made Julian gag. Voices shrieked from the forest, ragged and almost inhuman. Lehman staggered, clutching at her chest as if feeling something release there. Sophia caught her before she fell, but Lehman could not tear her eyes away from where the body of the man was still burning. They approached slowly.
"Had to be her."
Rose was struggling with each word, her hand clutching Henry's arm. her eyes locked on his stricken face.
My baby. Shadows.
Shh, Henry said, trying to staunch the flow of blood from the cut with fabric torn from his robe.
Don't speak just yet. It will be all right. Be still, darling. Be still.
Leman ran to him, and the man glanced up, desperate. He shifted to allow her to inspect the wound with careful hands. She reached for a small leather bag draped from her belt, one of her own knives.
I understand now. You led them away from us, didn't you?
He was saying to Rose, distracting her from Lehman's work.
Clever, clever, darling. You won't go, now that you've only just arrived, will you? Won't you stay for just one more dance?
Just beyond them, Etta was on her knees, heaving for air, trying to crawl toward her parents. Julian started toward her, but she waved her hands, trying to control her crying so she could speak. Nicholas thought he had never seen anything so brave in his life.
The astrolabe!
Etta pointed toward the nearby patch of forest, squeezing the words out between her tears.
I can't! I can't do it! It's...
Footsteps crashed through the forest. Voices cried out, searching for the astrolabe. Shadows, undeterred, finishing what their master had begun. He pulled Julian away from her. They were nearly out of time, and he loved her. He loved her. He loved her enough to not go through with it, to not leave her side. Which meant he had to go, and it needed to be now. He and Julian broke apart to search with nothing more than a frantic look between them, Nicholas bracing himself against one tree, then the next, making his way through the darkness. In the distance, he saw two shadowed figures weaving through the trees. Branches and rocks mauled and battered him on all sides. But he kept his eyes on the ground, searching through the pockets of darkness, the shifting dirt, the patchwork of ferns and shrubs. The breath burned in and out of his lungs, and his side began to ache in a way that might have doubled him over, if he were not so singularly terrified for the lives of everyone he had left behind on the path, of the way the shadows around him were beginning to shift and gather. But he felt it. He felt the vibration, the dread that broke out across his skin. Slowly, he turned and retraced his steps to where a glimmer of ancient gold peered out of a small animal's burrow. His left hand was slick with his own blood, from the deep cut which he'd been a fool to get. It had been protesting each time he so much as twitched a finger. He hardly felt it now, hardly felt the cold, or took notice of the way his hot breath steamed out into the air. Hardly heard Sophia and Julian calling out to him. Time seemed to bend around him, encasing his body in amber. Even his movements felt distressingly forced, as if he were struggling to move forward against a great wind, without a line to assist him. But he knelt. He crawled. He took the considerable weight of the astrolabe in his hand, staining it with his blood as he removed his dagger from his boot with his other. Touching it flooded his senses, shot his blood through him with dizzying heat. He felt the astrolabe pulse, as if with his own heartbeat, its pace increasing to match the slamming of his heart. Now that it was in his hand, his reason for taking it slipped out of his mind. He couldn't quite remember it, not with the images that suddenly flooded his field of vision like dreams borne on the wind. Standing on the bow of his newly commissioned ship, the wind fair and the ocean tame, as he gave the order to change course. Moving through a great house, chasing a small child across the soft oriental rugs, beneath the portraits of ancestors and descendants yet to come. Sunlight spilling in through the tall windows that overlooked the green lands below. His mother, taking his arm as he led her away from the fields, from the plantation, from the illness that had killed her. And Etta. Etta, in the silk dress he had seen her wear to dinner on the Ardent, the one that had suited her so well, guiding him forward to a passage, her smile dazzling. All of this. He heard the sweet whisper of words as clearly as if someone were sitting beside him. I can give you all of this. Nicholas did not want to pull back from these dreams. He wanted to live each moment through to its conclusion, to see what other sweet wonders might be offered to him. But the light, the mist hanging over his mind, it all pulled back. It left him in the darkness again, with a choice. A man made his own future. He chipped it from whatever hardships insinuated themselves into his life. He carved out the happy, glad moments to capture his gratitude for them. It came from the simple magic of merely living, of surviving, seeking. Not this. Not this. Using his wounded hand, he pinned the astrolabe to the ground and raised his dagger, driving it down hard against the metal surface. If he could just crack it, if he had just enough strength left in him to wedge it apart. The astrolabe heated beneath his hand, scalding to the touch. Nicholas let out a cry but held it fast, blinking as it began to glow. He drove the dagger down again, piercing its center. The hotter it became, the more malleable it was, until at last the bulk of the blade broke through its case, and the black blood burbled up from inside, spilling against his hand, searing it with a pain that whipped him down to the seat of his soul. He fell back, his jaw working out a scream as the light around him flooded his senses, drowning out the image of Etta racing toward him, her mouth open, calling something to him, trying to tell him something. But the light swept over her, and she vanished, dissolving in front of his eyes. "No," he thought, trying to rise again. "No!" The sound of thunder and fury bore down on him, drowning out her name. There was a tug at his back, a weight that wrapped around his core, and he felt himself lifted, pulled and tossed, the pressure crushing against his skin. The whole of the world tilted around him as time caught him in its torrential stream. And in an instant, Nicholas felt himself vanish. New York City. Present day. 32. Somehow, Etta knew exactly where she was, even before she had the courage to open her eyes and see for herself. "This isn't happening. This can't be happening." The stone stairs were cold against her skin, smelling of nothing more than the museum's old air conditioning system and the lemon-scented cleaning product the custodians used to wash the stairs down. "Get up," she ordered herself. "You have to get up." Did she? Etta forced her eyes open, forced the breath to come into her lungs, and then out again. With arms like wet clay, she pushed herself up, biting her lip to keep back her grunt of pain as the aches and bruises made themselves known again. The fluorescent light was nearly blinding. After living with sunlight and candles for so long, she shielded her eyes as best she could, lifting her arms, curling her legs toward her as she slid over the last few inches, to rest her back against the closest wall. She was still wearing the white robe. If it hadn't been stained so thoroughly with gore and dirt and soot, Etta might have believed the whole thing to be some sort of desperate dream. That she'd tumbled down the stairs on the night of her performance and knocked herself out. But she wore the evidence of her struggle on every inch of her skin. The bruising and dried blood decorated her like war paint. Alone, she thought. Trapped. For once in his miserable life, it seemed Cyrus Ironwood had told the truth. But the last thought lingered as a question. Slowly she unknotted the hooded robe, and used the relatively clean inner side to try to wipe her face and arms. Her clothes were from the last century, but this was New York, where there was always something or someone more interesting to look at. She tried to swallow the taste of smoke and blood in her mouth, and forced her eyes to take in the familiar empty stairwell. This was the passage that had taken everything from her. The same passage that had opened up a link to the past and carried her over land, across oceans, through time. She had arrived at the place she had departed from, back in her native time. This is home. What was left of it? Etta rose to her feet slowly, struggling for balance. Memories swirled there, all floating colors and sparks. not of the life she had lived, but of the destruction, the devastation of what New York had become in the altered timeline. Anger climbed in her as her feet took the steps, blinding her with its intensity, so much so that she had to lean heavily against the rail to keep from falling back. Nicholas had done it. He had done this to her, to them, to everyone. Her mother was bleeding to death somewhere that wasn't here. That Atta was sure of. Her father was alone in his own time, wondering what had become of the two of them. Julian would be left to his own devices. Sophia and Li Min, separated. The remaining thorns blown apart and scattered to the winds. Just for a moment, just one, she thought she might actually hate him. Why had this been worth it? Why had he done this to them? She drew in one breath, then another, trying to control the shaking that racked her entire body. She smoothed her hair back, wiping the drying tears from her face. As she reached the top, voices drifted to her from beyond the door. The muffled wailing of a child. The endless stream of footsteps squeaking against the floor. But there, inside the stairwell, was nothing. There was devastating quiet. Etta's breath hitched in her throat as she turned, looking down the stairs again. She hugged the folded robe to her chest. There was no shimmering wall of air to call her back, no thundering drums to announce her arrival. There was no passage at all. There was only Etta, alone. As it turned out, the inside of the Met was the same, with enough small exceptions that Etta felt as though she were moving through a kind of Shadowland version of her city. Exhibits had been moved. The style of clothing she saw around her seemed sharper, shorter, brighter. Even the cell phones people carried to snap photos of the artwork were unfamiliar, razor-thin and sliding open like the old mirror compact Alice had carried to check her lipstick. Etta kept her head down and moved steadily past the school groups and couples meandering through the halls, through the blessedly familiar Egyptian wing, down the grand staircase, and out into whatever waited for her beyond the doors. It was disorienting, the way the skin of the city had changed, even if the bones had not. Etta recognized the older buildings, the old houses turned museums, lining Fifth Avenue. But when she jogged around to the part of the museum that backed up to Central Park, she faced an almost unfamiliar crowded skyline on all sides. Historic landmarks like the Dakota were gone, replaced by ever-reaching skyscrapers that literally blocked out the sunlight and cast impossibly long shadows across the park. The trees had changed color and were burnished with all of their golden autumn glory. Strollers wove through the park's paths. Men in suits passed men out for a jog in the crisp weather. Women sharing coffee and conversation on nearby benches glanced at others making business calls as they power-walked by. It was a variation on the theme Etta had known and loved, and now she would need to study it to understand the underlying notes that had changed. She wondered if the city had always been this loud, this clean, this frenetic. Henry had said the timeline tried to account for inconsistencies and restore as many traveler events as they could. Maybe Etta's life here was what it had been, at least mostly, even if the trappings had changed. She had lost everything and everyone else. Maybe she could at least have the scraps of her old life. She felt the pressure of eyes, and turned to find a young girl staring up at her, sucking on her thumb as she held her mother's hand, waiting for the light to turn. Etta tried to smile, but she'd noticed others giving her a wide, silent berth, and she could only imagine her smell and how out of place she looked, despite having lived the whole of her life on these streets, moving through the veins of the city. When the little girl and her mother crossed Fifth Avenue, heading home or to a shop, to some real, concrete destination, the wave of longing and uncertainty and desperation finally broke over her. And Etta began to cry. "You're overwhelmed, but it's all right," she told herself. "You are all right. Give yourself a minute. Give yourself time." But there was nowhere for her to go. There was no one. Unless... Etta turned, crossing the street just as the signal began to flash. her jog turning into a full-on sprint through this new, slightly changed version of the Upper East Side. She dodged sleek city cabs in their familiar shade of yellow, delivery bikes, and the parade of evening dog walkers. The sun was setting at her back as she turned onto Alice's street, and she felt her heart jump at the sight of her brownstone, looking almost exactly as she remembered it, the pots of flowers still alive on her stoop. The front windows were dark, but she tried knocking anyway. She stepped back, and then knocked again, practically bouncing with anticipation. When there was still no answer, when she was sure her heart would beat its way out of her chest, Etta dug down in the base of the pot of pansies, dumping the dirt out onto the stoop, well aware that Martha, Alice's snoop of a neighbor, was watching her through the window. Her hand had just closed around the spare key hidden at the bottom when Martha's front door opened.
"Etta, is that you?"
She straightened slowly, hoping she'd managed to clean the better part of the blood from her skin.
"Yes, it's me."
The old woman, already in her paisley silk robe, pressed a hand to her chest.
"My goodness! We were so worried about you and your mother when we didn't see you at the service. It's been months, doll. How have you been? Alice was so excited for you to come back to the city for a visit. And goodness, you look as if you've crawled out of the ground."
"Surface? Months?" Etta had to swallow the bile down, forcing a smile that was more of a grimace.
"I've been traveling."
Martha seemed to accept this, at least.
"That house has been sitting empty for an age. If you'd like a referral to an agent to sell..."
Etta's hands were trembling so hard she could barely fit the key into the lock. It was a difficult door no matter the timeline, apparently. She had to shoulder it open.
"Careful there!"
She stumbled inside, her chest heaving, and slammed the door shut on the woman. Gasping, Etta dropped to her knees, bracing her hands against them until she had the courage to look up. The whole apartment smelled as she remembered it. The cinnamon apple potpourri Alice favored, and Oscar's pipe smoke, which had lingered long after he'd passed away. Etta leaned forward, pressing her face to the old blue floral rug covering the hardwood, and let it muffle her scream of frustration.
"She's dead. She's still dead.
And her home was as buried as she was. Every piece of furniture, every piece of art, every surface was covered with white sheets." Etta breathed in through her nose as she stood, leaving a trail of dirt across the pristine floor in the living room. The floorboard squeaked as she approached the couch and placed a knee on it, pulling the fabric away from the painting hanging there. The city sang its melody of horns and trucks and rattling garbage containers outside. And all the while Etta stared at the impressionist field of red poppies, raising a hand to touch the paint, to brush the dust from its frame. She moved from room to room, uncovering pieces of Alice's life, photos of herself smiling naively, unscarred in and out, with her mother, neat stacks of bills, an unfinished novel on the bedside table, her violin, the one she'd gifted to Etta years ago in the old timeline, rested in its case on the bench at the foot of the bed. Etta sat beside it, flipping open its latches, and for a long while did nothing but stare at it, brush the glossy surface, breathe in the wood and rosin with her filthy fingers.
"I'll be seeing you."
The words emerged broken, battered, in all the old familiar places. But there was one painting she had never seen before, resting just outside the floor of Alice's closet, as if she'd gone to hang it up but forgotten about it. Having grown up in the halls of the Met, Etta recognized the Renaissance style of the piece, from the pose of the young woman to the warm, vibrant tone of its colors. It was so unlike the other pieces in the apartment that it drew Etta forward for closer inspection. The ivory dress with its square cut was detailed with gold thread, but otherwise simple in style. The subject's golden hair was plaited down her back, crowned by a circlet of lush red roses. In one hand she held a map, in the other a key. The eyes staring back at her were her mother's. Her fingers touched delicate brushstrokes, and the roses blurred in her vision like an open wound, This was Rose Linden's natural time. Alice had indicated it to her the only way she could, by keeping this relic of the past. Sensing or knowing that Rose would never get around to telling her daughter herself. Etta couldn't push the chill out from beneath her skin, any more than she could stop the shaking that overtook her as the vicious reality set in. She did not think she could ever forgive her mother, not fully, for taking Alice's life, no matter the reason. But she pitied Rose deeply. She felt an unwanted empathy trying to imagine making that decision with the trauma of her past, and the promise of more death to come, wringing her neck like a noose. She understood now that Rose was as much the hero as she was the victim of her own story, blooming in blood. Etta wanted to speak to her, to understand, to finally clear the air between them, even if it was only one last conversation. And now it would never happen. At least 500 years and a single deadly cut had stolen their last chance. If her mother had survived, somehow survived, there was no way of finding her. Etta sat on the carpet for hours, considering her mother, considering the life they'd had together. The sun tracked around Alice's room like the arm of a clock. Alone. Finally, thirst won out. Etta rose, carrying the portrait back across the apartment with her to its new place in the living room. In the kitchen, she went straight for the refrigerator. She'd already noticed that the water was running when she'd stopped to wash her hands and face, and the electricity, too. But she was surprised, somehow, to find that the food stocked inside the fridge had already been cleared out, leaving only a few water bottles. Who had done that for her? Who had cleaned this place and covered everything inside of it? Her answer came in the form of a letter, resting on the kitchen table, beside two heavy letter-size envelopes. One was labeled with her name, the other with Rose's. Dear Spencer family, my name is Frederick Russell, and I have been appointed by my firm to handle Mrs. Hensky's estate. I was recently asked by Mrs. Hensky to serve as the executor of her will. As you may already know, the bulk of it has been left to your family in a trust, but I have been unable to reach you by means of phone or netgram to confirm this. Netgram? Whatever passed for email in this timeline, most likely. I am leaving these envelopes here per Mrs. Hensky's request, and against my better judgment, as I believe they may contain personal material both sensitive and valuable. Funds to maintain the utilities and upkeep of this home, as well as its taxes, will be paid out of the trust until you specify otherwise. Please notify me the moment you arrive, so that I may explain these next steps to you. Still taking care of us, Etta murmured, folding up the letter and the man's contact information. She reached for the envelope bearing her name and dumped the contents out onto the table, finally taking a seat. Inside, as the lawyer had expected, were personal documents. A birth certificate, a passport, a social security card, and vaccination records. Real, copies or forgeries, Etta wasn't sure. She turned her attention to the letter itself, hoping for some clue. It was dated July 3rd. Dearest Etta, I don't know where to begin. It has been only minutes since I last saw you. Both you, and to a lesser extent, your mother, have been appearing and disappearing almost at random throughout the years. There have been moments when we are sitting together at a meal, and I'll rise to refill my glass of water, only to return and find you both gone. I cannot tell you what has become of the timeline, only that it must be very bad. Your great-grandfather tried to explain the idea of imprinting to me once, how the timeline adjusts around the traveler's actions, and when it can't, it leaves impressions of them behind to maintain consistency. I wish I'd paid better attention. The great gears of time are shifting, and I am powerless to do anything other than watch. I remember our encounter in London as if it were yesterday. I remember the look on your face when you saw me, when you spoke of what our life would be together. I believe I have lived it in pieces, not the whole, perhaps, but I am grateful to have been your instructor and your friend. I am grateful I saw you become that young lady with my own two eyes, but I am afraid for you now. I've seen the world shift around me in tremendous waves, destroyed one moment, healed the next. I know it must be tied to your search, and I know my own end. The one I saw so plainly in your face must be near. And so I've taken precautions for you, should you return to an unfamiliar city. These documents should suffice in establishing a life here again, should you choose to. Should you choose to. These words strike me as odd, because it seems as if there has always been a kind of inevitability to your and Rose's travels. Those of us left behind, perhaps, can see it more clearly, the way it all eventually weaves together and connects. There are patterns. Loops are opened that ultimately must be closed. The choice is whether or not to open new ones, I suspect. Doc, you are the pride of my life. I should very much like to hear you play again, and I hope to see you return to me soon. If not here, then in the past. I've tickets to a concert at the Met in September, a night of Bach. But the only question is whether or not this blasted timeline will straighten out again before then, and weave you back into my days, in time for us to go together. Oh, God. Of course the timeline would restore that moment to the best of its ability. She clearly wasn't a part of the concert. But what were the chances that she and Alice had still gone? That she had heard the sounds of the passage? That she had bumped into Sophia and followed it? Fairly good if she had to guess. But if something should happen before then, or if you are reading this years and years from now, and I've merely kicked it from age and whatever else life has decided to throw at me, I wish to tell you only this. I love you and your mother beyond time and space. Etta read and reread the letter before returning it to its envelope. She arranged it at the center of the circle of documents she'd laid out, and began to consider her options. The passage was closed. Whether there was another one this year, or any forthcoming year, remained to be seen. If any still exist at all. Her mother, as far as she knew, was not here. Nicholas was not here. The only name she had that might be able to help was a lawyer named Frederick Russell. And what news he had about this supposed trust, this apartment, might turn out to be bad. Alice and Oscar had done well for themselves, but neither was astronomically wealthy. This fund would not last forever. But it might last enough to get her through school, until she found a job to support herself. "Don't be afraid," she told herself. "It will be okay." She would do what any traveler would in a foreign place and time. She would blend into the life around her, to the best of her ability. She would disappear into it, observing, learning, living. Essa would wait. The only question now was, for what? New York, 1776. 33. Nicholas awoke with a mouthful of dirt and the sounds of fife and drums battering out a march nearby. Despite the rawness, the crustiness of sleep, he cracked one eye open to take in the gray, hazy light. The dirt beneath him had soaked through his robe and his shirt, and created a freezing cast over his skin. "Cold," he thought. "Pain," his body relayed back. It was as if that one word was enough to wake it in him, the agony. His left hand burned as he flexed it, bringing it up to wipe the dirt from his face. Looking directly at the wound, he discovered, only made it bloom hotter and quicker. He turned the palm of his left hand up, staring in horror at the slices that ran from the base of his fingers to the heel of his palm, and the mutilated flesh of the burns that covered the rest of it. Nicholas drew it closer to his face because, yes, there. The swelling had yet to subside, and the tender pink of the raw flesh seemed to burn its way down to his bones. But he saw the pattern in it. He recognized the looping lines and nonsensical symbols, the mysterious secrets they held. He carried a nearly perfect brand of the astrolabe on his flesh. And if his past history with scars was any indicator, likely would for the entirety of his life. The white light. All at once, the memory pierced him, and he jerked up out of the mud with a desperate gasp.